At the Commonwealth Policy Foundation, we try to approach the issues of life, marriage, religious liberty, and fiscal integrity from a biblical perspective that promotes thoughtfulness and kindness. We work with political leaders and concerned citizens from all across the state. To stay informed, visit commonwealthmatters.org and sign up for our e-newsletter. The Commonwealth Policy Foundation is a nonprofit organization that only exists because of friends like you. Thanks for tuning in to The Commonwealth Matters.
Joining me to talk about higher ed in Kentucky is Dr. Aaron Thompson, the president of the Council on Postsecondary Education, which is the coordinating agency of institutions of higher learning in the Commonwealth. Dr. Thompson, welcome to The Commonwealth Matters.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Thanks for the invitation. I look forward to being on your show.
Well, it's good to have you here. And of course, your office is just down the road from here, not very far at all. I've been there. Full disclosure, by the way, I serve as a board member on the Council on Postsecondary Education. And Dr. Thompson and I both believe that education is important in personal success and increasing the well-being of Kentuckians, right?
Well, yeah, absolutely, we believe that. And not only that, I will tell you that in order for us to have a strong economy in this state that's sustainable, we're going to have a strong educated workforce. In order for us to have a strong educated workforce, we're going to have a strong higher education system. That's the most direct correlation to economic well-being, sustainability. I won't even get into yet, I'm sure you want to talk about it later on, all the other benefits of higher education, but that's one of the more powerful benefits.
I agree. We have had some recent conversations on what hinders younger people from going on to higher ed. And I guess we should define higher ed right now. There's a mindset, Dr. Thompson, that higher ed means a four-year degree, a master's degree, PhD. Explain how CPE views higher ed. How would you define that?
Well, you know, I did a listening tour about 3 years ago, and I went around the state and talked to all kinds of folks, families of P-12. I talked to people in higher ed, talked to business and industry. It was amazing how many people thought when I said college or higher ed that I'm talking about a four-year degree. Well, not in this state, and not actually in most states, but our state is if you get a workplace certificate, anything beyond high school, no matter if it's a workforce certificate or a PhD, that's higher ed. And all of those fall under our purview at the council.
So CPE is for education that's not just the four-year bachelor's degree, but for that certificate. It could be a six-week or an eight-week certificate that would include becoming an electrician, or it take a little longer for that, diesel mechanic, welding, something like that, all the way to the two-year community college degree.
Absolutely. And one of the things that I want to say, and I'm saying this as a guy who has a PhD, not everybody needs a four-year degree. Not everybody may need a two-year degree. This is why we have to do a better job, Richard, I think, very early, and I know we're going to talk about that, early in the quote-unquote the academic lives of students, to talk about exactly what higher ed is and how it fits who they are. And that's really a key that we haven't fully gotten down yet.
I think what you're saying is probably refreshing to a lot of people, because there's this mindset that higher ed, again, is 4 years, like I just mentioned, but a certificate, a two-year degree, something that fits that person and what they're made for, that is higher ed. And for you, PhD, person that's directing, a major influencer in higher ed, I think it's refreshing for people to hear that they don't all have to go to college. I took that path, by the way. That's, for me, I didn't have a family that had a business. I didn't have good job opportunities other than minimum wage. And I did go on to higher ed. And I'm glad I did. I want to step back to the thing that causes young people to believe that higher ed isn't for them, or where they lose this love of learning. Because you and I have had some conversations on at what point do kids, and it's usually in middle school, maybe early high school, that they lose their love of learning. I'm going to cue this up by an article that Arthur Brooks wrote recently in The Atlantic. He is a regular contributor to that magazine. His title, the title of the article is this, "School is Lonely and Boring." Brooks says this, "As a child and young adult, I hated the drudgery of school. I don't remember ever looking forward to a day of class from kindergarten until I dropped out of college after my first year. leaving felt like a pardon from the governor. This is fascinating because Arthur Brooks has three higher ed degrees.
Right.
He's a professor at Harvard University. He's authored New York Times bestsellers. He's an in-demand speaker as well. And I mention this because his story and your story, if I remember correctly, are somewhat similar because you were frustrated with school and you didn't see yourself moving on to higher ed at some point. So what changed for you?
Oh, wow. That's a great question and probably would take up most of your show, but I want to fairly get it to a point of where it makes some sense quickly. I will tell you, my father was illiterate, couldn't read nor write. Mother had an eighth grade education. But my mother taught me, as an example, Richard, how to write my name in cursive. By the time I was four, I could read. So when I entered school, they made me stop writing my name in cursive to learn how to print in order to write my name in cursive. Now, it was very frustrating to me, but the example I'm giving, we lose our kids through what I call a rote process. Many kids aren't challenged, and aren't challenged academically, true enough, but we also don't instill that love of learning. We make it a chore. We make it something. That's why we push so hard for this third grade reading. What we see is not only are they not, if you're not on standard at third grade reading, it's not that you are just behind academically. Mm-hmm. We start seeing you're going to be behind socially, emotionally, culturally, because we see this happening more with many of our low-income kids and kids of color. What we've done is that we've taken the love of learning out of learning.
And that's where I was. I've always been a curious kid. I've loved learning in the early grades, but I think the rote part of it, or the, well, like Arthur Brooks said, the drudgery, there's at some point for some of us that it just throws a wrench into it. This is what Arthur Brooks said. I'm going to go ahead and quote a little more from that article. For many children, school is not just hard work, but it's also intensely isolating. Research shows that 80% of children face loneliness at times in school. That emotion is linked to boredom, inactivity, a tendency to withdraw into fantasy, and a passive attitude towards social interactions. That statement was exacerbated during COVID, wasn't it? When kids couldn't go to school. They were sitting in their home, often a bedroom, with a computer, no interaction with their peers, no interaction with their teachers. And it really, we're finding that it has created a mental health crisis, hasn't it? But the isolation and the loneliness are factors that kill the love of learning. What's your experience? What can be done to address those two things, isolation and loneliness? And of course, with COVID, there wasn't a lot that could be done. But what would you suggest?
Well, to me, you bring up one of the more important points that we could talk about in higher education or in all education. Let me give you an example of something, then I'll answer your question more specifically. When we've done research and we looked at everybody that actually failed out of school or did not make it for academic reasons, we've only seen one thing they had in common. And that is they studied alone. That's the only thing they have in common. Think about that for a second. Mm-hmm. What we realize, we're a communal being. Mm-hmm. We in America, in our educational system, we almost force you in isolation being alone to learn. You learn better with other people. I promise you, you do. You and I learn better by communicating than we do just by sitting and reading by ourselves. And I can show you that evidence. The point being is that we also see by the time you're 11 or 12, peers have such a significant influence on your outcomes. And my mama used to say, boy, you hang out with the no good, you'll be no good. Well, what that told me and what I've tried to implement with higher education, set up a formal mentoring system of the good, right? Of the kids that are going somewhere and they build off of each other. They can even compete with one another, see which one's going to be academically or socially, get ahead. But you bring up another point, and I think this is a point we need to be talking about. We had some issues with mental health before COVID. COVID has not only put us behind 11 or 12 months academically with our young folks, mental health has exacerbated, partially because they have been at home, partially because there's all kinds of other dynamics that happens at home that many kids got away from in some cases when they went to school. You know, in some cases, they even got food when they went to school. Yeah. Yeah. That's why you see some of the schools delivering food. There's so many dynamics here that point to what we need to be doing systematically in thinking about how do we increase learning and the love of learning. And the point you're bringing out here may be the most important point you make today about how we should be conceiving what learning is and how we sell learning and how we get kids engaged. I call it skin in the game. How do we have them to devote more of their personal times to that, not only academic endeavor, but to that process of social emotional?
That's very good. So friendship, Brooks goes on to say, at school is by far the biggest predictor of enjoyment and positive behaviors. According to a Gallup survey, they found that having a best friend at school is the best predictor of student engagement in both the 5th and the 11th grades. So that's that peer support that right. You're talking about.
It is. And by the way, the 5th and 11th grades are transition grades, as you all know. That's when you know whether or not you're going to be, we lose a lot of kids, maybe not fully dropping out, but we lose a lot of kids socially and emotionally in the 5th grade. So between the 5th and the 9th grade, if we haven't captured them by the 5th grade, then we're going to lose them. And they're probably going to basically drop out in the 9th grade. And we see that.
Is there any effort to work specifically in the 5th grade? Because it's those younger years that really matter the most. Is there any effort being done to bring in mentors into the 5th grade classroom with kids who may be at risk, or to somehow encourage and to foster that level of learning? What's being done?
You know, we are doing one thing. We have our Gear Up program, which is statewide, where we start working with young people in the 7th grade. And we see at that point in time, we try to capture them there and make up for some of the loss. Your point is well taken. How do we get even in the lower grades? And this ed continuum that the Commissioner of Education, Lieutenant Governor, and I are leading are talking about that. How do we look at those transition years and make sure we don't lose people? I call it pathway, process, pipelines, and potholes. Those are pothole years for many of our young people, especially those that are the most disaffected based on low income, based on a variety of other.
Very good. We are coming up on a break, but when we come back, I'd like to talk about maybe those things. We're sharing some of the numbers, the financial benefits of pursuing higher ed, but there are some things like student debt and the fear of taking out loans that might be holding some back. I'd like to come back and talk about that when we return from the break. So stick with us. We'll be back in just a moment.
Hi, Richard Nelson here with the Commonwealth Policy Center. It's clear that we're living in confusing and challenging times where law and culture are increasingly hostile to Christian values. So how do you maintain your faith and convictions? That's a question that we're helping to answer at our Christianity and Culture conferences. The goal is to help believers to understand the culture and how to respond in an effective and winsome way. And we'd love for you to join us. The first two were well received, and we look forward to seeing you at our fall conferences in Bowling Green, Paducah, and in Somerset. To find out more, go to CommonwealthPolicyCenter.org. That's CommonwealthPolicyCenter.org, and we look forward to seeing you there.
Welcome back to the Commonwealth Matters. I'm Richard Nelson, Executive Director of the Commonwealth Policy Center, here with Dr. Aaron Thompson, the President of the Council on Post-Secondary Education. And just before the break, we were talking about the financial benefits of having a higher ed degree. If you're a bachelor's graduate from Kentucky, if you have a bachelor's degree, 8 years after graduation, over the lifetime, let me take that back, over a lifetime, you will earn, the median income is $1 million more than a high school graduate. These numbers are further broken down. I want to go into 8 years after a high school graduation. Before I jump into that, I want to go into, so we see the numbers. The numbers are clear that you will benefit financially, and yet there is concern about attaining too much student loan debt. There is concern about even going into debt at all. How would you address that, that factor holding kids back?
Well, let me just say this clearly. I think student loans can be an investment if it's done correctly, and this is where we haven't done as good of a job as we've needed to. For an example, we see young people borrowing too much money for the degree or credential they're obtaining. That, to me, is somewhat criminal, right? I mean, maybe not by law, but that's somewhat criminal. Or if they get a loan and they don't get that credential, that's really bad. So when we think of student debt that's bad, that's where it falls into. One of the things we've done, as you all know, Richard, you approved it. We did this student right to know.
Yeah.
We wanted one of the first states to do this up front. We want our students to know, here's the degree, here's the credential that you get at this institution. You choose the institution, here's the real numbers. This is the amount of money you're going to make when you get out in these job categories. And this is what the average borrowing is. So we want you to know and want to be up front with you about what you should. Because this is my argument, that there is an affordability issue here. And I'm proud, thank you, by the way, for voting for 4 years in a row. We're going to have the lowest tuition in almost 30 years in this state. That's one way of thinking about affordability. Another way of thinking about affordability, too, is helping the student know how he or she can finance his or her college in the best way possible and the minimal way possible, where they know they're going to get that return on investment faster, because they're going to have to buy a home, support a family or something afterwards. So we have to think of this in a longer term way. What my argument is, yes, borrow money if you need it, but borrow the right amount of money. And we need to be helping you to know how to do that.
The student right to know is a great thing. It's similar to Truth in Lending. If you charge your credit card up, the credit card companies need to tell you how long it will take you to pay off that debt in X amount of years and how much interest you have paid as well. I think that's a good analogy.
Yeah, that's right.
I think that's a good policy. If I could press on that, you said something just a moment ago about it being criminal for students if they take out too much student loan debt, or if they don't finish their degree or their credentials. Who's responsible? I think there's probably some responsibility that goes all the way around, but how would you address that? The word criminal is pretty strong.
Criminal, and it's an incorrect word to use. It's not against the law, obviously.
Right.
But as a guy who was poor, who had to work 11 at night, 7 in the morning, who had to do everything he needed to do in order to get an education. So I think it's shared responsibility. I don't want to take anything from the student, but it's our job to educate the students to know what he or she should know. To ever assume that a student knows that is problematic. Yeah. We need to be working harder. I'm proud to say in Kentucky in higher education we're doing this, to let a student know, okay, yeah, you can borrow this amount of money, but why would you want to? You can get by with what you need, including room and board, with this amount of money, and this is what you're going to get in return. So it's our job to advise them. But I think also, and this is where we don't talk about this enough, I think we also have to do a better job of educating our parents, educating even some employers to help us to do this, our community folks, our churches, other people who are a part of it. I actually think it's all of our responsibility, because we're talking about building a citizen. Yeah. We already see the return on investment. Just the tax-wise is a great investment, but it's also building up the communities with good citizens. And I argue that it's a shared responsibility, but as the head of higher ed, I take it on my back the most,
okay,
is the way I see it.
So the buck stops with you.
It does. And so I'm going to do all I can do policy-wise. I may not be able to solve everything, and I may not be able to make everybody happy while I try to solve what I can, but I believe it has to be something we, Richard, as the lead state entity for higher education, to talk about what's good for our citizens, what's good for our students, and what's good for the state as we do that.
Very good, very good. I'm going to go back to the financial benefits, because we do talk about this, and this should be, it is one of the factors that should lead us to pursue higher education. It's not the only thing, but it is a thing, and it's important to know the differences between just getting a high school degree and getting a bachelor's degree. So according to the CPE research of Kentuckians who went to school here, high school graduates earn a median annual salary of $29,478. Certificate and diploma holders earn $37,369. And by the way, this is 8 years after high school graduation. Mm-hmm. Associate degree holders earn $38,268. And on-time bachelor's degree holders earn $41,915. So you see a difference in the earning capacity just 8 years after high school graduation. Those are real numbers of real Kentucky students. And I'm saying that again because for those kids who are listening or those parents who are listening, who might be holding back or saying further education past high school is not for me, the numbers bear out that it is a good investment.
It's a great investment. And think about those years. I mean, those with baccalaureate degrees, you've only been out working 1, 2, or 3 years. Those with high school diplomas have been out working 8 years. And so that's even that's after right. 8 years. So if you think about those, just getting a short-term certificate pays off almost right. immediately. But I'm going to say one other thing. What we also know is if you look at people that are on unemployment, you look at the health of people with degrees or certificate versus those that don't, many of those high school folks will have a greater chance of having worse health mm-hmm. and having to spend some of their monies on trying to get better health care. Mm-hmm. So what you have here is, as you increase in educational attainment, your health tends to be better. We talked about it earlier, your mental health tends to be better, your and social health and so on. So without a doubt, if you think about 8 years you're working, you're still making significantly less than someone who's been working 1, 2, or 3 years. And so if you can imagine the escalation of that, guess who's going to get the raises and who's going to move up the ladder, right?
Those who have an education, those who bring their mind to the table, if you will. And that's one of the greatest things we have is our mind, our brains, our skill set that we can, as we learn, as we grow, that brings more to the table for the employer, but it also brings more to the table for the community as well. I want to go to, you talked about health. That's one of the benefits of getting a higher ed degree. But happiness. Arthur Brooks says, when it comes to long-term well-being, few interventions raise happiness as much as education. In 2015, and he refers to a study done by Austrian researcher Eric Streising, using data from adult populations across 85 countries, Streising found that people who had completed high school were 10% more likely to say they were happy than those who hadn't graduated from high school, and that's after controlling for income differences. Those who completed college education raised their happiness level, this is their self-reported happiness level, by 30%, nearly a third of those who went on to college. Now, it might be tough going through a course of study, especially if you're in math or the hard sciences, but it pays off in the long term with happiness. Now, here's the thing. Brooks says that it's one possible explanation of that is that learning stimulates a basic powerful emotion, which is interest. And exposing people to ideas and the means to acquire knowledge gives them the tools to produce ongoing happiness throughout their life. I find that fascinating.
To me, it is fascinating. I've done a lot of brain research also, which we don't have time to talk about today, but it plays into this. Let me be clear about what I'm saying here. My father had no education. He was a wise man. He could build any tool he wanted to. But he would tell me, boy, get an education where you won't have to break your back in a coal mine. Education gives you options. Lifelong learning gives you options. It also stimulates what we call the smart gene, right? Mm-hmm. It stimulates your ability to want to learn more. You know, if you read one book, you won't read the second book, I promise you, because you got invigorated by the first book. And so what we see is, and you know, that you also have a higher social viability level. In other words, you're going to make more friends, you enjoy being around, and you're going to do more things together, which increases happiness. You're going to do, and I just have to throw this in, if you look at the people in prison, I mean, look at the educational levels. If you look at the people on unemployment, look at the percent of people on Medicaid or people that are on other forms of social welfare. I'm not saying they're not happy. My point being is they may have less options. So options in many cases, real options that you understand that you have, gives you a greater chance of actually finding that happiness place. But don't let me skip over what you were really saying. The dynamics of learning, the interactions of learning, increases a process to where you enjoy life more. Yeah. Nothing like reading a good book on the back deck as the sun shines on you.
Yeah, no, that's good. So we're winding down. We have just a couple minutes. And I want to talk about, in these last remaining moments, the Council on Postsecondary Education's 60 by 30 goal. Can you briefly speak to that?
Sure. What we've done, and we looked at research. I'm a statistician by trade, so I'm always doing predictive whatever. But what we found out, for Kentucky, we are 44th in the nation. I mean, that's not a good place. What we argue is that by 2030, if we have 60% of our population with at least a credential that matters in educational attainment, we are going to get close to building that educated population that sustains us. And so we're pushing that we need to increase. And I'm happy to say that we needed about a 1.7 percentage point increase a year to get there. Yeah. We're doing about a 3.5 percentage point. So we are not only on target, on trajectory, we're a little bit above. Now, we have to see what COVID does to us. We know it's going to do something. For me not to say that would be a lie. But we don't know exactly what yet. But that's what we're pushing.
That's good. And I'm proud of being on CPE for doing that. That initiative is a bold initiative. We're seeing progress. And we're seeing, in the end, kids benefit from that. We've got just a moment. There's one thing I want to bring into this. I don't know if I can do it in a minute, but on the Commonwealth Matters program, we often bring in a faith perspective. And unfortunately, in my work, sometimes, Dr. Thompson, I see faith pitted against education. And I'm reminded of the first great commandment, to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And developing our mind is one way. We have incredible capacity as individuals. And furthering education, learning under others, developing a skill is one way we can develop our mind. But CPE develops relationships and different interest groups, reaches out to them. You did mention churches. Are there churches in the Commonwealth that get behind higher ed initiatives or education initiatives in general?
Well, you know, some do. Obviously, you see a lot of parochial schools out there that's doing that, and they're pushing higher ed, no doubt. But I guess I want to say something personally. I don't normally talk about this, but I first learned to read out of the Bible.
Okay.
My name is Aaron, where that came from. Good. You know, the idea that if I didn't have a faith, I believe there's something bigger and stronger than me. You know, this is not me proselytizing by no means. Yeah. Faith is truly what got me from that illiterate coal miner's sharecropping house in Clay County, Kentucky, to where I'm the head of higher education. Yeah. So what we've got to do is not just about whether or not, but we've got to get our formal organizations, our churches who are formal organizations, forget what denomination they are, forget even what religion they are. But what we've got to do is come together as a community and say, how do we build the best possible community that we possibly can build what we need?
I wish we could talk further about that, but we are out of time. Dr. Thompson, it's been so good to have you joining us.
Thank you, Richard, for inviting me to join you, sir.
God bless you. You keep up the good work.
You too.